Welcome to another episode of the Fantasy Writers Toolshed. I'm your host, Richie Billing, and today I'm delighted to welcome a truly special guest, former FBI Special Agent Joe Navarro, who is an expert in body language. And the reason I've invited Joe along is to discuss the importance that nonverbal language has, particularly in writing. It really is one of the best interviews I've ever had the pleasure of doing on this show. So I think you're going to enjoy it. We've also got some brilliant guests confirmed for future episodes too. So if you don't want to miss them, be sure to subscribe or follow the show. And if you would like to support us and keep us doing these episodes and maybe even do even more regular ones, share it with anyone you think may be interested, as well as on social media. If you'd like to get more involved in our buzzing writing community that's grown around this show, as well as get access to writing classes, books, interviews and guides, check out our Patreon page. And now it's time to dive right in and get some truly masterful insights from one of the world's leading experts on body language, Joe Navarro. I'm honoured to be joined today by former FBI Special Agent, best-selling author, and a world-leading expert in body language, Joe Navarro. Joe, welcome to the show.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
Thank you very much for joining me. I think when I sent you an email a few weeks ago, even I appreciated the randomness of it, reaching out to an expert in body language like yourself. But the reason why is because I think it plays such an important role in fiction and storytelling as a whole. I mean, if you look at like TV and film, like body language is one of the main weapons of an actor to convey how they're feeling or what they're thinking. And right. I suppose with books, we get a little bit more leeway, don't we? Because we can dive into the thoughts of a character. But I still think that there's a special thing about body language. And for me, it's because if it's only suggested to us what a character's thinking, it's more interesting because we have to think about what is that they could be pondering.
Yeah. Well, thanks for having me on your program. Somehow you convinced me to do it. And I think in part because I love good writing. I can appreciate good writing. People say, well, you've written 14 books, and I say, well, I'm more of an author than a writer.
Yeah,
I think writing is a true skill set because it is both storytelling, but it's also, as you said, how do we convey emotion, right? So we can say, well, the person looked troubled, or you know, Hilary Mantel who sadly passed away, would say with furrowed forehead, he looked down at his shoes or something, and maybe conveys the sentiment that way. So I have a high appreciation for those who dedicate themselves to writing, and having read about Hemingway, you know, and how he would sit in front of that typewriter for 2, 3, 4 hours just working on one sentence. And if you stop and think about that, it just tells me how much further I need to go, because when you think the old man in the seat was written at the fourth grade level, and he won a Nobel Prize for that.
Yeah.
And then you go back and look at how he wrote that, and you realize that he had mastered words, but he had also mastered how to convey sentiments. And really, I often speak as an anthropologist would. Our species primarily communicates nonverbally. And though we take it for granted and we don't really pay too much attention to it unless something really stands out, it is what defines great actors. When you look at Marlon Brando or any living actor, the great ones, you could turn the sound off and you could see it in their faces, exactly what they're feeling, thinking, or desiring. And and so the your audience, people who are writers or potential writers, I think to make writing interesting, I think nonverbals is an area that really has to be mastered, as Shakespeare did.
I think it's definitely underused. Like you say, I've always thought it was more important than dialogue, arguably. And like you've just confirmed it there, haven't you? That most of the communication that we share between us is nonverbal.
Yeah. Think about it. We, things like trustworthiness, we don't ask people if they're trustworthy. We assess it from their body language. We assess whether we're safe around other people based on their body language. We make this life changing decisions, like who we're going to marry, based on body language. And it's the primary means by which we communicate empathy.
Yeah.
So it's all around us. It's always with us. We just think that our words are important. But I think, as any good writer knows, that the subtle nuance of human emotion is really conveyed with nonverbals. I mean, I was looking at a period piece last night, and just the subtle touch of one hand against the gloved hand of the woman.
Yeah.
Okay, so there's a nonverbal that's extremely powerful.
Yeah.
Just that conveys so much information that she didn't move her hand away.
Yeah.
And you can draw a lot of inferences from that.
So how did you find this particular interest in body language? You've had a really interesting career. Is this something that you've always been interested in, or is it something that you've sort of found as you've worked your way through life?
Yeah, good question. Well, I was born in Cuba, and I didn't speak English. And then when the communists came, we fled, and we were exiled, refugees, and ended up in Miami. And just out of necessity, I found that the only language I could trust was the body language.
Yeah.
I couldn't speak English, and I know some Brits would say, well, you still can't, mate, but
I get that.
but body language seemed to make sense to me. It was clean, it was pure. If somebody likes you, you know it. If they don't, you can tell. If they're genuine and so forth. And so I began to rely on it. By the time I got to college, I was studying anthropology on my own, and I found it that it was fascinating to look at the gestures and just the body language around the world. And even though my degree was in criminology, my field of study, my dedication was to body language. And it's one of the fortunate things in the United States that you have the freedom to study whatever you want.
Yeah.
And I did, and it interested me. The interesting thing about body language is nobody owns it. Psychologists think they own it, but they don't. Anthropologists think they own it. Ethologists think they own it. It's one of those ologies that everybody contributes to, but nobody owns. And because of that, at least when I was going to university, you really couldn't get a degree in it. So I just took it upon myself to study it. For no other reason than just to please myself. And of course you have a tremendous advantage when you can walk into a room and read the room.
Yeah.
And you can see where there's issues, there's concerns, who's getting along, who's not, all sorts of things that you can infer from body language, because we evolved as a species to communicate nonverbally, principally, because at least for the last 300,000 years, from the time we were archaic humans, we lived in a world where we were small, we had no defenses, we had no claws, and we were surrounded by large predators, namely felines.
Yeah.
And we had to communicate silently and effectively, and move about in very silently. So it became our primary means of communication. You couldn't go through an African savanna going, "Hey, Charlie, what's going on?" We would have died out as a species.
Yeah.
We had to do so very silently. And so we evolved things, which is part of our nonverbal repertoire, such as the freeze response. We hear a loud noise and we freeze in place.
Yeah.
We hear bad news and we freeze in place. Because whoever made noise attracted the predators, and whoever ran would initiate the chase, trip, bite sequence that all cats, all felines use to catch prey. So those who ran got eaten. Those who remained very still got to pass on their genes, and thus much of our body language. For instance, the celebrations around the world are always up and out, right? We raise our hands when we score a goal.
Yeah.
And we don't have to be given a memorandum to do that. It's universal that anything that is positive emotionally, we use gravity-defying behavior. So these things are hardwired in us as a species.
So, I mean, you mentioned there, like, the power of being able to walk into a room and reading what people are thinking and feeling. I mean, how easy is it to interpret these things? I mean, you've devoted your life to it. I mean, if someone, like a writer, for example, wants to learn a bit more about how to do that, I mean, what sort of advice would you give them?
Well, there's a lot of advice. We'll keep it compacted here because there's a lot of great books. I mean, everything that Desmond Morris, who for a long time lived in the UK, I think he lives in Ireland now. Any book by Desmond Morris, who looks at the world as a zoologist, is essential. And, well, any of my books, if I can mention it, What Everybody Is Saying, or The Dictionary of Body Language, which has about 400 behaviors. What these books can do is help you to say, to look at, for instance, well, what can we gain from this area of the body, right? So if you're a writer, and you're looking for a way to show that somebody is stressed, but it's very subtle, you know, you could say, well, you know, the muscles of the neck tightened, or his Adam's apple jumped.
Yeah.
Well, we've seen that before in the literature. But what if you were to say there was moisture began to build up in the little area just below the nose? We call that the philtrum. So those lines down from the nose, those are the philtral columns. And humans begin to sweat in this little area when we're under distress. Or, you know, so somebody said something nasty and there was no immediate reaction except for the wings of his nostrils reddened just slightly, and one might even say began to flare. So this could be interpreted as a pre-event indicator. The person's oxygenating and he's going to take a punch or something.
Nice.
So if you know the human body, for instance, the shoulders, that when we are confident, we tend to raise the shoulders up dramatically and say, I don't know where he went, right? You just imagine both shoulders going up, hands palm up, and so forth. But how subtle a change it is when you describe somebody and says, and he said, I don't know where they went, but only one shoulder came up and the other one remained low. Well, yeah. That's lack of confidence. So you can use it to really heighten the sensation,
yeah,
of understanding your character, understanding what that character is going through. For instance, you could have a character that from the waist up looks very calm and very serene during an interview, but under the table, you could say, well, and he was wiping his hands on his pant leg, or his ankle was quivering.
Yeah.
And then you realize, oh, this guy is masking from the chest up, which a lot of people can do. Poker players do that, but it's very difficult to mask the whole body. Or even something so simple. You know, I talked about earlier about the hand of the in that period piece where he reached over and touched the woman's gloved hand, and you know, you get a sense for they like each other. The space between the hands and fingers, for instance, when we're confident, the distance between fingers tends to spread. And when we lack confidence, we tend to withdraw the fingers together or hide the thumb.
Yeah, that's a really subtle one, isn't it? I've never noticed that one.
Yeah, you often see this at carnivals where they put people in this spook house and they're confronted with spooky things. And when they take a picture of them, you see the thumb is retracted. And the reason for that is, just like dogs tuck their ears in, humans tuck their thumbs in so that they don't catch on things as we're running through a jungle. Of course, we don't run through a jungle anymore, but this was beneficial to us, at least from when we were early hominins about 2.4 million years ago,
yeah,
till about 6,000 years ago when we entered Mesopotamia.
That's crazy, isn't it? I was going to actually ask you about a few of these emotions, Joe, and the typical actions we might see in body language. You've mentioned a few really good ones, but I was going to ask you about dishonesty. If someone was trying to hide something, what kind of...
Yeah. Dishonesty is really difficult because first of all, the research tells us that humans are really lousy at detecting deception. Now it's bothering me. I said entered Mesopotamia about 6,000 years ago. Probably entered Mesopotamia about 10 to 13,000 years ago. But anyway, there's a lot that's been written in the literature about deception, and most of it is wrong. First of all, there is no Pinocchio effect. There is no way to detect deception accurately using body language. Now, humans are very good at reflecting that, what I call in my book, psychological discomfort. So in my book, What Everybody Is Saying, I talk about psychological comfort and discomfort, and that we humans, from the time we're born, reflect whether we're comfortable or uncomfortable. And that discomfort, it can be because of the room is too warm, and so we begin to ventilate by lifting our clothing, or women lift their hair up, or because we don't like a question that we're being asked.
Yeah.
And when we we are psychologically uncomfortable. We see manifestations that may be anxiety. It could be tension, but it can also be dislike and disdain. You often see this where I know I have a trouble with this. Every time I go through security at the airport, you know, and I'm thinking, what is the statistical significance of somebody my age doing something harmful?
Yeah.
And I know that I probably have an annoyed face, right? I try not to, because these people, God bless them, they're just trying to do their job. But I reflect in real time what I'm feeling.
Yeah.
And it has nothing to do with harming anybody. It has nothing to do with deception. But we do reveal our sentiments that way. And so I would tell writers, don't look for a behavior. You know, I remember in the 70s, you would still read a book where somebody said, oh, he touched his nose and so he's lying, or he looked up and to the left and so he's lying, or he covered his mouth as it turns out the honest as well as the dishonest do that. But I think if, as a writer, if you want to be authentic and structure it around their responses to questions, that somehow you can see the psychological discomfort. I'll give you an example.
Yeah.
Right. So rather than go for a confession, you go for admissions, because 100 admissions in the end equal a confession. Now in the movies, they always go for the confession. You know, that's so much crap. Because, you know, I've done over 13,000 interviews and you don't set, I mean, yeah, you know that eventually, hopefully you'll get a confession, but that's not the bar you set. The bar you set is FaceTime, get the person to talk to you for as long as possible. And eventually, they'll tell you everything.
Yeah.
And so that's your first objective. But the second one is, I always went for little admissions. And so rather than, did you shoot her with a Smith & Wesson 9mm in the head causing cranial damage? You just gave up so much to work with that even the innocent would sit there visualizing this ma'am. And you would see psychological discomfort. And so I would parse it, and interwoven with other questions, I might say, almost like the old television show Columbo, say something, by the way, do you happen to own a gun?
Yeah.
And then you pause. And you wait for the answer, but you also look to see what's the reaction to that question. And they may come back and say, "Yes, I own a hunting rifle." Okay. Do you own a handgun? No, absolutely not. And then you see the confidence, right? So maybe they answer that with a what we call prosody, which is the tone of voice and so forth. And then you may follow up with another question like, well, have you ever owned a 9mm Smith & Wesson?
Yeah.
And, you know, so by parsing things, you can look to specific reactions. I'll give you another example.
Yeah.
Somebody reports finding somebody dead in their house, and of course they're under suspicion. I would begin with, well, when you got home, where did you park your vehicle? Did you park it on the street? Did you park it in the driveway, or do you have a garage? and then began to, and when you got out of the car, did you lock your car? Did you leave your keys in the car, or did you go to the door? And then you go, which door? Was the door locked or unlocked? You know, and then you take, you see what their reactions are to each and every question. And what happens is they become accustomed to minutiae. They don't see it as threatening. But if somebody, in my experience, if somebody's harboring guilty knowledge, the incremental technique begins to you begin to see more and more distress. You may see the flushing of the skin. You may see, you know, the nervousness and so forth. Where with the honest, they will, as long as this has been your methodology, they will tell you, well, I can't, you know, I can't remember. I must have put the keys in my pocket, because I never leave it in the car. And then I went to the front door, and there, you know, I found that the door was actually ajar. And you don't see the psychological discomfort. But when you load a question with too many things, then it really loses its validity as far as being able to assess accurate information. So it's almost impossible. You can describe something so horrific that the person for the next 20 minutes will be trying to, you know, clean their brain of what you just discussed. And I've seen a lot of investigations ruined that way.
Yeah, I imagine that, because it's so, in them interviews, it's so finely balanced, isn't it? It's like a real, I don't know how you do it, really. 13,000 as well isn't an amazing number. So, what kind of things would you be looking for then? I mean, it has to be, I'm guessing, some of these people that you've had to interview are like masters of deception, and it's like a cat and mouse. I can imagine, like, you're just looking for the tiniest little thing that could just...
Well, yeah, that's a good question. Well, first of all, I think you need to get... I wouldn't say there are masters of deception. I would say that there are people who habitually lie.
Yeah.
And if they're not questioned, right? If I as a person don't do my due diligence and question what they say, then they're going to get away with a lie. I remember years ago, I ran into a guy, and my mother introduced me as a FBI agent. She was very proud, and I really didn't want anybody to know I was an FBI agent, but she did. And she said, "Well, so and so, he had similar work." And I go, "Oh, okay. And what were you?" And he said, "Well, I was in military intelligence." Oh, that's interesting. And I never believe anything anybody says, because it's not that I shouldn't say I don't believe. I always remember it's self-reporting, right?
Yeah.
Well, you can self-report anything. and so I followed up with really, it was a benign question, but it was pointed. And I said, did you work with the 902nd? And he paused to think for a minute, and he says, "Yes, of course." And so then I invented a number.
Yeah.
And I said, "Well, then surely you must have worked with the 83rd MI group also." and he said, "Oh, yes, of course. Very familiar." Well, I just made that up.
Awesome.
And as it turns out, this guy had been bamboozling people in this condominium, telling them that he was military. The guy never served. I mean, you could just tell, you could just look, take a look at the way he walked. But yeah, some people just, you know, they habitually lie.
Yeah.
But if you don't call them on it, but I've yet to meet someone who could cognitively keep up with a proper interview, because lying places such a cognitive load that you might remember, for instance, I'll give you an example. Here's one your readers will appreciate. A liar will remember the facts he wants to convey, right? Yeah. Oh, I came home and I found her dead. Okay, that one's easy. What they don't think about is the emotions that they felt each step of the way. And that places a cognitive load.
Yeah.
And they have to really think hard about, oh, how should I be feeling at this moment? How should I be feeling at this moment? How should I be really feeling at this moment? So a simple question would be, well, as soon as you opened the door, what did you feel?
Yeah.
And somebody might say, I had a sense something was wrong. Okay. And then as they reveal that they found a body or whatever, you ask, well, how did you feel at that moment? Now, feelings register, especially strong negative ones, register in the hippocampus. And the hippocampus, of which we have two, keep a pretty good record of everything negative. And we evolve that so that we only burn our hands once on the stove.
Exactly, yeah.
So everything negative goes right to the hippocampus and it stays there. And so for the liar, they have to think hard about, oh, what's the emotion I should be feeling right now? And and that's always an interesting area to pursue, because I've literally had them sit there looking at the heavens thinking, how should I answer this one? And they don't realize the clock is ticking.
Yeah.
And they're thinking. And sometimes they'll actually say it as a question. I was traumatized.
Yeah, like not sure.
Well, you either were or you weren't.
Yeah. I tell you, people must have had no chance going up against you, Joe.
Well, let me say this. I went up against some very good liars. And I can tell you that they were able to get away with the lies because in those instances, I didn't have access to the evidence, right? Yeah. So I one of the best liars I ever went up against was a woman who committed espionage. She eventually was committed to 25 years. But the evidence of everything she said was overseas or in the possession of Russians. And the Russians weren't being very helpful then, and they're not being very helpful now. And so there was no way for me to contradict anything that she said.
Yeah.
And she knew it. She said, she was stationed in Germany. She said, well, you could go to Germany and check it out. Well, eventually we did. And it took about 6 months to catch up with her lies. But it wasn't so much that she was clever at lying. They flowed from her.
Yeah.
It was just that we were hard pressed to corroborate everything she said. And mind you, and people forget this, that it doesn't matter for an FBI agent, it doesn't matter if you're honest or dishonest. If you're going to use information from, let's say, a witness and you're going to go to court, you have to corroborate what they said.
Yeah.
You know, if they said, I was standing here on this street and I could look down and I could see this happen, you have to go out there at the same time of day and see if you can corroborate that, because if you don't, defense counsel will. So people think we only corroborate or try to corroborate what the bad guys say. No, we have to corroborate both, because otherwise, you're an attorney. Defense counsel will just shove it down your throat.
Yeah.
And say, well, Mr. Navarro, did you stand in that corner? No, sir, I don't. Well, did you know that if you look down that road, you can't see anything? Oh.
Beyond all reasonable doubt, isn't it?
Well, people have faulty memories and so forth. And they think they saw, they think they heard. And I'll never forget the first time I went to a bank robbery. I was in Phoenix, Arizona. And this was a time when banks, my gosh, they would have 6-7 tellers at the same time.
Yeah.
And I remember taking statements from them, and they all described the gun differently. And I was in shock. I always thought that human memory was like a video recording.
Yeah.
And you realize that it's not, that the person who had been directly in front of the bank robber, she described this huge gun, and everybody else who saw the event described the weapon differently. Everything from a 6-shot revolver to a shiny pistol. And I was like, are you serious?
Oh, a head scratcher.
but that's what you go to court with whatever the witnesses, so you go out and you get 7 or 8 different guns, and you put them on a photo lineup, and you try to narrow it down.
Well, I've got one final question for you, Joe.
Yeah.
You've written 14 books, is that right? So far. And I know that you mentioned to me that you were starting to look towards fiction writing, which is very exciting because it's got so much experience and insight. I can't wait to read what you're working on.
Thank you.
As you've been working on this, how have you applied your experiences, and what advice would you give to anyone out there listening who's looking to utilize body language a bit more in their stories?
Yeah. Well, first of all, thanks for encouraging me, because I need it. as Hemingway said, writing is easy. You sit in front of a typewriter and bleed. I find writing prose is very difficult, because for 25 years, I wrote as an FBI agent. And so writing prose is very difficult. But I would encourage everyone to include the body language, because it just gives it greater flavor. It gives it greater nuance. Think of your audience, right? So there are cultures which are very rich in nuance, right? So in Asia, Japan, the Middle East, much of the Mediterranean countries. And so the gestures, the physical responses convey a lot of information, where, yes, in certain cultures, words are more predominant, but it just adds so much to it. And it's one of those things that can help you to shape the feelings at the person, because of what we call mirror neurons, right? So if you purse your lips, right, in the forward position, and then dramatically pull them to the left or right, if you were to sit there and study how you feel, you would feel, oh, this really feels negative, or I do that when I disagree. It just adds more to the description of what a person may be feeling. And in the end, it's easy for an editor to take it out if he or she doesn't like it, or if it doesn't hit the spot.
Yeah.
But it's so much more difficult to add it in later.
Yeah.
And so I would argue, you know, you look at somebody like Hemingway, and you know, his language, his prose was so sparse. But then you read somebody like F. Scott Fitzgerald or Hilary Mantel, and you see the richness of the body language, and you really feel like you're there observing, feeling the sentiments. Yeah.
Ah, fantastic, Joe. Thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me. It's been an amazing conversation. I think you've been one of my favorite guests on the show, definitely by far. Thank you very much again.
Thank you. And as I'm looking at your body language, I think you're actually being honest.
Can't get away with that, would you? But Joe, how can we find out a bit more about you?
Well, you can just plug my name into to Google, and it'll come up. But joenavarro.net should get you to my website, and all my books are in the major bookstores and certainly on Amazon. And I would encourage them to browse the books and pick out some really good body language to convey the feelings. And I would also add, don't focus so much on the face. Those are the easy ones.
Yeah.
Focus on the little things that we do with the rest of our body. With our hands, with our legs, and so forth, and add to the richness of understanding your character.
Amazing, Joe. Yeah. Thank you again, and thank you everyone at home for listening. Joe, a big thank you again for giving up time out of your very busy schedule to chat with me about body language. And again, like you say at the start, you don't do a lot of these interviews, so I'm sure if you're listening at home and you enjoyed that, you're very grateful to Joe. It is a real pleasure to interview people at the very top of their field, and I learned so much from just chatting to Joe for that hour, and hope you learned something new too. If you enjoyed today's episode, be sure to follow or subscribe. And if you really did enjoy it, please consider leaving us a rating on the Spotify mobile app, or a quick little review on iTunes too. A quick share on social media also helps us out an awful lot. And the more people who listen, the more episodes we can do. And if you'd like to get involved in our writing community and get access to fantasy writing classes, books, interviews, guides, and much, much more, just check out our Patreon page. You can also join one of our half dozen writing groups with people meeting up every 2 or 3 weeks to get feedback on their works in progress. So yeah, check out the links in the description. And we'll be back on the 14th of March with a very interesting interview with one of the world's best-selling fantasy authors. And it's someone that you probably haven't heard of before, but it's going to be fascinating. And I really can't wait to bring you that one. So that'll be coming out on the 14th of March. And until then, keep on scribbling.